Well, we are in 1 Samuel chapter 12. I really wanted to move further than just one chapter this evening, but if you get into 13, you have to cover 14 and 15 as well, because those three chapters go as a unit. So next week, the plan is to cover chapters 13, 14, and 15. But this evening, we will focus just on chapter 12. Chapter 11 left off with Saul's great victory over Nachash, the general of the Ammonite army. It was the Ammonites, wasn't it? The Ammonite army. And Nachash means serpent. And Nachash wanted the people to submit to him by the men plucking out their right eye. And we discussed that last week, how the right is the sight of the spiritual. And the serpent, the enemy of our souls, would conquer us by making us spiritually blind. If you just look at the world through the eyes of the flesh, you're no threat to the enemy. But when you can look at the world through the eyes of the Spirit, you're a huge threat to him. So, Saul conquers in that war, and now the people seeing, okay, this guy Saul, he must be the one God has chosen king. Samuel must have been right when he said this is the man God chose. And so Samuel gathers all the people, says, gather at Gilgal. Now, Gilgal has quite a history. If you go back to the book of Joshua, this is near the area where the Israelites crossed into the Promised Land. It's where they celebrated the first Passover in the Promised Land. This is where the men were circumcised after 40 years in the wilderness. And it seems like it's a place of new beginnings, a starting place. And so Samuel chooses it. And he gathers the people there. And then in chapter 12, verse 1, Samuel begins his, not quite a farewell speech, but kind of, I'm stepping down. I'm going into semi-retirement. Up to this point, Samuel had been the judge and the prophet over Israel. But now that Israel has a king, Samuel's no longer going to operate as a judge. But he will still be God's prophet for quite a few years yet. And this is what he says. It's been Samuel said to all of Israel, behold, I have hearkened to your voice, to everything that you have said to me, and I have crowned a king over you. And now behold, the king who walks before you. But I have become old and gray. As for my sons, here they are with you. And as for me, I have walked before you from my youth until this day. Samuel sounds like he might be a bit proud, but we know he wasn't, because if he had been, God couldn't have used him. But Samuel was humble and a realist, and he realized that God had raised him up from his youth to be a leader of Israel, but they had rejected his leadership. So it's like, okay, I went to God, he said, that's okay, give him a king. Samuel says, okay, fine, that's what God wants, you can have your king. But he goes back to review history. And look at what he says. I have walked before you from my youth until this day. Verse 3, here I am. Testify about me in the presence of Adonai and in the presence of his anointed. Whose ox have I taken? Whose donkey have I taken? Whom have I robbed? Whom have I coerced? And from whose hand have I taken redemption money that I should avert my eyes from him? In other words, bribery money so I wouldn't give a fair judgment. Tell me, I will make restitution to you. And they said, you have not robbed us, you have not coerced us, and you have not taken anything from any person's hand. Now what's interesting here, the word take is used four times. The exact same number of times it's used back in chapter 8, when the people ask for a king, and Samuel tells them, you really don't want a king, because he will take, he will take, he will take, and then he's going to take. And he lists all the things the king's going to take four times. But Samuel says, but I've taken nothing from you. Now, one of the things that's wonderful about Samuel, we can glean a lot of insights from this short passage, are qualities of a true leader. This chapter 12 of Samuel is the half-Torah portion for Parashah Korach. That's chapters 16, 17, 18 of the book of Numbers. Now, if you didn't understand anything what I just said, what I mean is this. The Torah is read on an annual cycle. And the Torah is divided up into sections, starting from Genesis 1, going all the way to the end of Deuteronomy. So each week, there's an assigned portion. And each portion is given a name. And later, about the midsummer, you get into the portion in Numbers, chapter 16, 17, and 18, which is called Korach, or Korah. Now remember the story of Korah? Korah thought Moses wasn't doing all that great job as a leader, so Korah wanted to be a leader. And it really troubled Moses, and Moses went before the Lord, just as Samuel went before the Lord, when the people asked for a king. And there are a number of similarities between the portion in Numbers and the portion here in 1 Samuel. Back in Numbers 16 to 18, we see the people reject Moses as their leader. And here in 1 Samuel, we see the people reject God as their king. Moses defends his motives, and he said, "I did not take." Samuel defends his motives and also asks the question, "Did I take anything from you?" And of course, the answer is no. In the story of Korah, a miracle happens. The earth opens and swallows up Korah. Think what a weird day that was. You know, you always talk about how I can't wait to get my feet back on solid ground. But after you see the solid ground open up and swallow up people, it doesn't seem so solid anymore after that, doesn't it? The whole world looks different to you after you've seen it open up and swallow up the bad guys. But in, here in 1 Samuel chapter 12, we see heaven opens and rain comes and damages the wheat harvest. Now we're going to get to that in just a moment. And in Numbers, we see Moses appeals to God, and here we see Samuel appeals to the people. So there are a number of parallels here between these two passages. So since I was, we taught on the Haftorah portions a couple of times over the years, I just went back and dug up some of my old notes on 1 Samuel 12, and I came across this one, and I thought, well, this is good enough to share with you. It comes from this passage here where Samuel talks about his leadership. And I had this overhead. It's called, "Your leader may be a schlub if." Now notice what Samuel does here. He says, "Here I am, testify about me in the presence of Adonai and the presence of his anointed. Your leader may be a schlub if he does not welcome examination. A true leader makes his life an open book, and he welcomes examination. A person who truly wants to better himself welcomes input from others. The person who's self-satisfied does not want any input from others. He wants to keep his secrets, he wants to live a secret life, and he just wants to be a leader when he's in their presence, and then he just wants to lead another kind of life away from them. But Samuel openly welcomes examination." You know, I've often said, if we could just look at our own souls as a set of clothes. You ever go into a clothing store, you go in the changing room, you try on a new suit or whatever, or ladies, you know, you go in and try it on. Ladies, let me give you some advice. If you're clothes shopping and your husband has been gracious enough to endure the agony of going clothes shopping with you, and you waltz off into a changing room with an armful of clothes, let me tell you something, a secret to a happy marriage. If you try something on, come out let him see it. Because nothing's more aggravating than she goes in all these clothes and she comes back out dressed in what she wore when she walked in. "Oh, I didn't like it. Well, can I see it?" You know, it's like, so anyways. Robin's in the nursery. I said, "I don't mind being in the nursery. I can talk about it then." So ladies, just keep a happy home. Even if it looks ugly, at least let him see how ugly it is. Then you go back in, and he's like, "Okay, I at least got to see what she's putting on." Where was I? Oh, if we could just look at our souls the way we look at a suit of new clothes. You put on something new, you come out and say, "What do you think? Does it fit right? Is it the right colors? What do you think?" Boy, if we could just do that with our souls. Go to those people we trust and love and say, here's what I'm about. This is what I'm thinking. This is what my life is. What do you think? What needs to change? What needs to be altered? What needs to be done? You know, if you had a shirt there and it had a stain, and you cleaned the stain out and you held it up and says, can you still see that stain? Is it gone to you? And the person says, no, I still see it there. Would you be offended? Well, I'm never going to show you my shirts again. You wouldn't do that. It's like, oh, okay, I need to work on it more. Because you don't take it personally. It's just a shirt. Treat your soul that way. When you ask someone, have I really improved this area? Do I have a ways to go? And they say, you know what? You got a ways to go. Don't get mad. That's your best friend who can be honest with you like that. Look at your souls like you would look at a pair of clothes, set of clothes. And then you could really make progress. Your leader may be a schlub if he takes advantage of those he leads. This is the difference between a shepherd and a wolf. A shepherd shepherds sheep for their health, for their good. I've always told you, you can tell a sheep from a wolf in sheep's clothing because a sheep eats grass and a wolf eats sheep. Does a leader try to gather people to absorb them into himself? Is he looking for a following? Does he want everybody to pay attention to him and follow him? If that's the case, you may be looking at a cult instead of a flock. And so Samuel openly asks, he says, whose ox have I taken? Think of oxen as the tractor of the ancient days. It was like a tractor. Whose donkey have I taken? The donkey was like a pickup truck. You use the donkey to kind of move things from place to place, but the ox is used to power the plow and to move large objects and heavy loads and to get the work done. Whom have I robbed? Whom have I coerced? Your leader may be a schlub if he oppresses those under his authority. He may be a schlub if he coerces those under his authority. I remember a couple experiments of trying to coerce you folks into doing things differently, and I learned very quickly I don't do that. And you know, you don't drive sheep. And if I ever try driving you again, just hit me with something hard and heavy. And I'll come back to my senses. You don't coerce people. I've given up trying to change people. And I've had a lot more peace in my life since then. I never try to change anyone. You know why? Because I can't. That's not my job. There's only one person on this planet I can change. And you're looking at me. My real estate extends to the size of this flesh I walk around in. That's it. Only one I can change. I can't even get Robin to come out of the changing room to show me what you just put on. Giving up on it. So, you can't change people. You can inspire people. You can try. You can model a life in front of people. You can change you and hope that light goes out from you and something goes out that people look at and think, I want that. But people change themselves. They desire something different from what they have, and they choose to change themselves. I've come to realize that. You can't coerce people. And a leader who tries to coerce people, all he has is a group of performing sheep. He doesn't have a family. He doesn't have a flock. He has performing sheep. And I will never try to get you folks to perform for me or anybody else. And I'll never allow anybody to come up here to try to get you to perform. I'll protect you from that. That's my promise. That's the promise. I can speak on behalf of the elders too, I think. We're not going to let anybody come in here to try to get you to perform for them, to act in some certain way. If your leader tries to buy your decisions, he tries to bribe you, he's a schlub, all right? Samuel says, from whose hand have I taken redemption money that I should avert my eyes from him? Who has ever bought me off so that I would not deal honestly with him? You know, a number of you have been very generous to Robin and me. You've given us gifts. You've given us things. And it's been wonderful. But, you know, every time I receive something from one of you, I have to remind myself, If there ever comes a time I need to rebuke that person, and that person asks me honestly what I think, and there's something there that a hard word I might have to say, I've determined right then and there I will still say it because I owe that to you out of love, to be honest with you. You need to do that with one another. You're welcome. I hope I never have to do that, though. But I always goes through my mind that I will love this person enough to be honest with them. And a number of you have asked me, what do you think? If this is what's going on in my life, is this right or wrong? It scares me to death when you do that. Your leader may be a schlub if he is not willing to make restitution. Samuel says, if there's anybody I bribe, or money I've taken from anybody illegally or in a wrong way, or as bribery, says, I shall make restitution to you. And you know, when I look at some of the people who try to pass them off as religious leaders themselves, as religious leaders, I look at these things and I see every one of them. Now, who am I to judge another man's servant? But you know, we are not to condemn one another, but we are to be able to judge fruit. And when you see this kind of fruit, people who don't welcome examination, they take advantage of those they lead, they oppress those under their authority, they coerce those under their authority, their decisions can be bought, and they are not willing to make restitution. That's bad fruit. And so if you see that kind of fruit in someone's life, regardless of how popular they are, regardless how gifted they may be, regardless how much they, how well they may know the scriptures, if this is the fruit of their lives, it's bad fruit. Right? So, anyways, so I know you're all thinking, is Grant a schlub? I know you're thinking. I am. A lot of times I am. I have to confess. But I'm trying to be more of a Samuel and less of a Shalom. Verse 4, and he said, you have not robbed us. It's interesting. It doesn't say they said. It says, and he said. In other words, all the people were speaking with one voice, and so God refers to all the Israelites as a he, as a singular. And he said, you have not robbed us, you have not coerced us, and you have not taken anything from any person's hand. So he said to them, Adonai is your witness, and his anointed one is a witness this day, that you have not found anything in my hand. And they said as one, a witness. Let me show you something kind of interesting about that word witness. What they said in Hebrew is just one word. They said the word aid, two letters, one word, aid, witness. That's all they said, aid, one word. And that one word is kind of interesting because it's spelled from the letter ayin, dalet. That's what it looks like. As most of you know who have looked at Hebrew at all, learned the alphabet, you know that ayin is the Hebrew word for eye, eyes. And this is supposed to represent two eyes, okay, and it's like the face and the chin down here, and it's looking this direction. And dalet is the Hebrew word for door. And here's the ceiling, and here's the door here. And this is the word witness. Whenever you think of a witness, it's a picture of someone who's watching the door. People are watching what's going in your life and what's coming out of it. Yeshua stands at the door of our hearts. He stands there and knocks and waits for us to open to Him. But there are a lot of eyes on your life. They watch what goes into your life. What are the things you draw into yourself? What are the things you read? What are the things you look at? What are the things you listen to? And they watch what comes out of the door of your life. And that's your witness. So what do people see when they stand at the door of your life and see what kind of traffic goes in and out? It's a powerful, powerful word, that word witness. So they say, we're witnesses. So verse 6, Samuel then said to the people, it is Adonai who produced Moses and Aaron, and who brought your forefathers up from the land of Egypt. And now stand erect, and I shall enter into judgment with you before Adonai, concerning all the righteous deeds of Adonai that he has done with you and with your forefathers. When Jacob came to Egypt and your forefathers cried out to Adonai, Adonai sent Moses and Aaron, and they brought your forefathers out of Egypt. Now, here's the pattern he's setting. You got into trouble and difficulty. You called out to God. God sent a rescuer. That's God's pattern. You were in Egypt. You called out to God. He sends Moses and Aaron. And they brought your forefathers out of Egypt and settled them in this place. But they forgot Adonai, their God. So he delivered them into the hand of Sisera, general of the army of Hazor, and into the hand of the Philistines, and into the hand of the king of Moab, and they battled them. Then they cried out to Adonai, and he said, and they said, we have sinned, for we have forsaken Adonai, we have worshipped the Baalim and the Ashtaroth. And if you didn't, weren't here for the teaching a few weeks ago where we discussed the Baalim and the Ashtaroth. It's pretty important principle in Scripture that's very applicable for today. But now rescue us from the hand of our enemies, and we will worship you. So what did God do in these three cases? And cases like them? So Adonai sent Zerubbabel. Now it's interesting, when he talks about how they worship the Baalim, the Baals, what did God raise up? A Jerubbaal, Yerubbaal. Which means Baal has been squashed, basically. That's a kind of a loose translation. The squasher of Baal. And who is Jerubbaal? If you go back to the book of Judges, it's Gideon. Yes, Gideon has another name. And a few places in Judges, he is referred to by this name. In fact, it's Judges 6:32 and chapter 7, verse 1. You'll see Gideon called the squasher of Baal. Who else did God send? He sent Bedan. Now that word, that name is not found here before 1 Samuel. But if we break the word up, it can mean Ben-Dan, son of Dan. And there is only one person that could be referring to, and that's Samson. Samson, the judge who came from the tribe of Dan. And what a powerful deliverer he became there at the end of his life. And Jephthah. And that's found in Judges chapter 11. You can read about Jephthah. And then Samuel includes his own name here. I don't think Samuel would do this on his own. But I think he was speaking by the inspiration of God. And he put Samuel there because he's saying to them, you cried out to God for deliverer when the Philistines came and they destroyed the tabernacle, they captured the ark, and all of this. And God used me to bring about that victory. And he rescued you from the hand of your enemies from all around, and you dwelt in security. But, he says, but now you've broken the pattern. In the past, you got into trouble because you'd forget God. And then you get into all this pressure and trouble. You call out to God. God sends a deliverer. Then everything's fine for a while until you forget God again. Does this kind of sound like your life? Right? You get into all this trouble. That, oh, what's wrong? Oh, I've forgotten God. I haven't been spending time in prayer, studying His Word, fellowshipping with believers, and obeying His commandments. And now look what my life is like. God, help me. And God does. The life is great. And so you kind of slip back into forgetfulness again. He says, but this time you've broken the pattern. But when you saw that Nachash, king of the children of Ammon, came upon you, you said to me, no, but a king shall reign over us. In other words, instead of calling out to God for help and God raising up a deliverer, you said, we want a king. We want a king over us. But Adonai, your God, is your king. He says, you've had a king over you all the time. But they wanted a king they could see and hear and touch and look up to and think, wow, look at our king. A king who could give commandments and raise an army. A king who's a lot less than God. You know, so many times what we ask for is less than what God wants to give us. But when we determine to keep asking for something, that is less than what God wants for us, sometimes He'll give it to us. Here's something you may want to remember. Answered prayer is not necessarily a sign of God's favor, but unasked for blessings are. You know, when people talk about how they prayed and God answered it, sometimes, in the pit of my stomach, I'm thinking, uh-oh, because there's something they said they probably should have been praying for that. And this thing that they've received is going to be just a monkey on their back. It's just going to be a burden to them. It's going to be crushing to them. And they're going to regret ever asking for this. I could tell several stories in my own life. I'm just too proud to share them with you. But I'd be totally humiliated. But you probably have your own humiliating stories where you've asked for things and you got them and think, oh, why did I ever ask for that? So sometimes God teaches us by giving us what we ask for. Verse 13, and now, here is the king whom you have chosen, whom you have requested, and behold, Adonai has set a king over you. You got what you wanted. Hope you like it. You won't. That's basically what Samuel's saying. But it's not the end of the world. God is still their God. They're still His people. The covenant is still intact. God's still their teacher. God still loves His kids enough to spank them and to make them better. And He says in verse 14, if you will fear Adonai and worship Him and hearken to His voice and not rebel against the word of Adonai, then you and the king who reigns over you will remain following after Adonai your God. But if you do not hearken to the voice of Adonai and you rebel against the word of Adonai, then the hand of Adonai shall be against you and against your fathers. And now for a second time he says, stand erect. Even now, stand erect and see this great thing that Adonai will do before your eyes. Is today not the wheat harvest season? In other words, it's about this time of year. You know, we're counting the Omer from Passover as we approach Pentecost, Shavuot, which is the time of the wheat harvest. And today is the 35th day as we count from Passover towards Shavuot. We only have 2 weeks left. So in Israel, this is the time of year that the wheat harvest is really starting to come in. 2 more weeks, you're going to harvest all of that wheat. And during this time of year in Israel, it never rains. It never rains. The rainy season is during our winter. And then the dry season is during our summer. So they save up water and they'll have irrigation and they'll have water for their crops and the water will be in the soil. But it never rains. You don't want it to rain during the wheat harvest because rain will destroy the wheat. So what does Samuel say? Verse 17, is today not the wheat harvest season? I shall call to Adonai, and he will set forth thunder and rain. Then you will recognize and see that your wickedness is great. That which you have perpetrated before the eyes of Adonai in requesting a king for yourselves. Then Samuel called to Adonai, and Adonai set forth thunder and rain on that day. And all the people greatly feared Adonai and Samuel. Why this sign? What's the point of destroying their wheat harvest? Well, it's really quite simple. Is a king a good thing or a bad thing? Well, it's a good thing. If it's God as your king, or the king that God chooses and God initiates to set over you, if it's a King David or a King Messiah, the son of David, that's a good thing. But when you go asking for a king when it's not time for a king, it's like asking for rain, which is a great blessing, during a time when it's a disaster. So a king out of season is dangerous and damaging, just like rain out of season is damaging as well. Now it's interesting, the Talmud points out this interesting fact about the poem that contains the line that the Lord shall be as the dew to His people. And they say, why does it say the dew? Why not the rain? They say, because rain can be damaging. But dew is always gentle, always helpful. It's always timely. And God says, I'll be as the dew to my people. Isn't that interesting? So rain out of season is a curse. And a king out of season can be a curse as well. In fact, in this case it is. Let me show you something else that's kind of interesting. It just came to me as we were reading Psalm 30 during the prayer service, where David is saying, you know, you've saved my soul from the pit, and you've lifted my soul out of the grave. How's it go? You've spared my soul from this descent into the pit, and you've rescued me. How's the phrase? I forget exactly. I have a terrible memory. But anyways, let me share something with you that Saul sparked. That psalm sparked. Let me write an English word here. T-E-A-R. How do you pronounce that? Oh. Tear, like a teardrop, or tear, like tearing a piece of paper. Two have nothing to do with each other. It's the exact same word. Same letters. How about this? S-O-W. Sow, like sowing seed, or sow, female pig. Right? Have nothing to do with each other, unless the sow eats your seed. Let me give you another word. Shin, Aleph, Vav, Lamed. It's the word Shaul, Saul. It means requested. We went over that, I think, last week, the week before. The word Shaul means requested. But you want to know another meaning for that exact same spelling, those four letters? Sheol. This is why you should be careful what you request. It might be hell. Isn't it interesting? The name Saul, requested, is also the exact same Hebrew word for Sheol, which doesn't literally mean hell. It means the grave, a place of death. We need to be very careful what we request of God. Okay. You know, the main thing I want to share with you this evening, in the last 10 minutes or so, and by or so, I mean 30 minutes or so. No, I won't do it that long. It's this. As I was reading this, I'd read it several times this week, but late last night, I was reading this and it just hit me. What a powerful passage we have in front of us coming up here, starting in verse 19. Let me set a scenario for you. You know, if you sin against a neighbor by something you said wrong, some attitude you've held, or some harm you've done them, and you realize that you've sinned, you confess that sin, you go to that person, you humble yourself, you make things right. If there's any restitution to be made, you make it right. You ask their forgiveness. And oftentimes, afterwards, you have a closer relationship than you did before. I know in marriages, this often happens. You can either allow that bitterness to build up and separate you, or one or the other can humble themselves and ask the other's forgiveness and repent of what they've done, make things right, and your marriage is actually stronger than it was before the error was committed. But what about those times? Through rebellion, sin, or just error, you have done something that is irreversible. Something tragic. There's no way in this world you can go back and make it right. Maybe it's even cost someone their life. Maybe you were driving drunk and you hit someone, an innocent person, and their life is lost. Or like the tragedy of Stephen Curtis Chapman, probably all of you heard about that this week, where his oldest son was backing out the van and ran over their 5-year-old daughter and she died. They were preparing for the son's graduation party, probably rearranging cars. And what was meant to be a celebration turned into a great tragedy. An abortion. How do you ever go back and fix an abortion? You can fill in the blank. What if it's something irreversible? How do you deal with the guilt? What do you do? And the answer is for us here. It says in verse 19, all the people then said to Samuel, pray on behalf of your servants to Adonai, your God. Isn't it interesting? They didn't say to Adonai, our God, but to Samuel, your God. The guilt of what they had done. They realized at this sign, when this rain came at Samuel's word, at the wheat harvest, it hit them like a ton of bricks. We've rejected God as our king, just as our forefathers have. And instead of calling out to God and asking his forgiveness, we pushed him aside, we pushed his prophet aside, we said, we want a king like all the nations. We've done something worse than they've done. They probably felt a million miles away from God. So they say, Samuel, pray to Adonai, your God. And you know, when you've done something horrendous, you don't feel like you can call God your God anymore. That we die not, for we have added evil upon all of our sins, to request a king for ourselves. So there we see the confession. There we see the confession. But you know, all the confession in the world can't undo what's been done. God has given them a king. He's been established. He's been coronated. He is now the king. They can't go on and do it and say, oh, no, we don't want a king anymore. That's kind of like the spies went into the promised land. They saw the land and they came back. And 10 of the 12 said, oh, we can't go up. There are giants there, blah, blah, blah. And so God decrees that, okay, you guys will just wander around here for 40 years until you all die. Your children, they'll go into the land that you're too chicken to go in for. They said, oh, we're sorry, we'll go in. He said, don't go in now, it's too late. Oh, we're going to go in. They go in, it's just terrible. They get whipped like dogs. It's too late, they can't undo the sin. So the sin is confessed, but what do you do now? Pay close attention to what Samuel tells them. Samuel said to the people, first of all, fear not. This is no time for fear. In other words, God's still with you. I think when we've done something horrendous, one of the things we do is we fear damnation. We fear we've lost our salvation. We fear that God is angry at us for the rest of our lives. We fear that we will never have his blessing again. We fear we're not good enough to be part of his people. We fear all kinds of things. All kinds of consequences. Oh, there are going to be consequences. But they're usually not the ones you expect. They're going to be perfect and measured out exactly from the hand of a loving God. But this is no time to cave into fear. So first of all, don't be afraid. Because after all, God runs the world. Your sin didn't take him by surprise. And God he's not in heaven throwing up his hands and saying, oh, what do I do about this? And oy vey. He doesn't do that. He saw the sin coming. No, sin is sinful and it's wrong and it's deadly. But it's never a threat to God. Never a threat to God. And then he tells them, do not turn away. I'm sorry, but do not turn away from following the Lord. Don't turn away from following Adonai. That's the first thing I want to do when I've done something terrible. I just can't live this life. I'm not cut out for a spiritual life. Well, I got news for you. None of us are. But God is determined that we'll learn how to live a spiritual life. I'm reading this book called Messy Spirituality. It's a wonderful little book. And I was reading some of it this afternoon, and it really is an encouragement to me that most of the people who think they're very spiritual and act very spiritual usually aren't very spiritual. But sometimes the ones we think are just kind of messy and sloppy in their lives are really the spiritual ones. And it's really an encouragement to me. But don't turn away from following the Lord. If you're trying to follow God to some extent and you did this terrible thing, how much worse is it going to be if you stop trying to follow God? If you follow him and goof up, you think it's going to be better if you don't follow him at all?
In other words, God still accepts you as His servant. Your service to Him might go through some change, some alteration. It may even improve. But don't stop following Him, whatever you do. And then He tells them, serve the Lord with all your heart. Don't stop serving Him. Again, the way you serve Him may change. You know, there are some pastors who've committed some great sin while they were in leadership, and they disqualified themselves from continuing to be a pastor. That doesn't mean they don't serve God at all. They may serve God now by sharing their testimony of what they were, what they did, how their lives have changed, and warn people, don't do this. God might use them in another powerful way to write a book. Maybe it's just a touch of life. Maybe their fall has caused them such a humiliation that now they're finally usable to God. Who knows? But don't stop serving the Lord. You may have to serve Him in a different way, but He's not done using you. He is not done using you. You know, I was reminded while I was thinking about this. Remember how Peter, at the last Passover Seder, Peter boasts, I'll never stop serving you and following you, Yeshua says, I will die for you. And Yeshua says, before the cock crows, you'll deny you even knew me 3 times. And Peter probably is even twice determined now to follow God, to follow Jesus and not deny Him. But you know the story. Before the cock crows, 3 times. Even the last time he curses. He curses to prove I'm not one of his disciples. I don't even know the man. And then he catches a glimpse of Yeshua at the trial, looking over at Peter, because he knew. Can you imagine how crushed he was? He had all the stuff he knocked out of him there. And I'm sure as he went away, you know, just broken for 3 days, I'm sure that, you know what verse or what statement of Yeshua's I know has run through his mind, where Yeshua says, if you deny me before men, I will deny you before my Father in heaven. And Peter had done it 3 times in just a couple hours. Imagine the guilt. But then you come to that marvelous verse there in Mark chapter 16, I think it's verse 7, where Yeshua is raised from the dead, and he gives the message to the ladies there. He says, go tell my disciples and Peter. In other words, he wasn't done using them. Wasn't done with him yet. And getting the stuffing knocked out of him was just what Peter needed. We all know what kind of death Peter did die eventually. They went to crucify him. He says, I'm not worthy to be crucified like my Lord. Crucify me upside down. And he went to his death boldly with strength. You know, there's an unbroken person thinks they can do anything. But God can do anything with a broken person. It's the only kind of people he can really use. Well, I love this next part, and this is so crucial. He says, he continues on, verse 21, do not turn away to pursue futilities that cannot avail and cannot rescue, for they are futile. That word futilities and the word futile, the word tohu, not tofu, which is futile, if you try to feed it to me, but it's tohu. Do not pursue futilities. The Hebrew word tohu is found way back in Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. Chapter 1, verse 1 says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Verse 2 says, the earth became tohu and vohu, empty and void, futile. What does the word tohu mean? The word tohu means a confused, empty thing that God has not yet spoken into. Because when God spoke into the confusion, when He spoke into this dark, soggy piece of confusion and emptiness, then there was light, and there was order, and there was life, and there was the animals and man and fruitfulness and all these wonderful things. But until He spoke to it, It was tohu. When a person has done something so awful that they think there's no remedy for it, and there may not be a remedy for it, they just want to give up on life itself. They just want to go into total emptiness. And when you do that, then sin has truly won. The enemy really has gotten the victory. And then look what Samuel finishes with in verse 22. For Adonai shall not forsake his people. They may forsake him, but he will not leave them. He will not forsake them. For Adonai shall not forsake his people for the sake of his great name. For Adonai has sworn to make you for a people unto him. And you look over the history of Israel, I can't see much on the list of things to do to make God forsake us that they haven't done. And yet God still is not forsaking them. And God won't forsake you either. So don't be afraid. He's still with you. Do not turn away from following the Lord. Serve the Lord with all your heart still. Do not pursue emptiness, futility. Don't just cash in and give up on life. God still has a plan. God is still faithful. And you want to know who illustrates this concept here? Because I know he was aware of this teaching of Samuel's. That's David. Go over to 2 Samuel chapter 12. 2 Samuel chapter 12. We're just going to look quickly at the story of David, the man after God's own heart, and the man who committed a sin that was absolutely crushing and irreversible. And we can learn from David how to take the advice of Samuel and put feet to it and live it out. Even from David's sin, we can learn some great things. You know the story. David, instead of being out in battle with his army, he decides to stay home and take a day off. And he's up on his roof one evening and looks out and sees Bathsheba, Uriah's wife. Uriah, one of the faithful warriors in David's army. Uriah's out at the battle. And David's home looking at his wife. So David takes her, commits adultery with her. She gets pregnant. He has Uriah killed in battle. He has Uriah put right up at the front and has his people, his men move away from him, so Uriah gets killed. And all through this, David doesn't realize he's done anything wrong. Because, and when we get to this, you'll find out that David never quite violated the letter of the law, anything he did. You may think, that's bizarre. I can't believe that. Technically, he did not violate the letter of the law in any of these things that he did. But he stomped all over the spirit of the Torah. He stomped all over it. And when Nathan, the prophet, finally came to David and in a very wise and pointed way revealed to David what he had done, it's all revealed to David that he was an adulterer and he was a murderer. And what does the Torah designate as the penalty for those two things? Death. Here's the king of Israel. David, the beloved, the psalmist, the one who's led Israel so many victories, the man after God's own heart, and now he deserves execution as a murderer and an adulterer. So what does Nathan tell him? Chapter 12, we'll start with verse 10. And now the sword shall not cease from your house forever. You brought the sword to Uriah and you had him murdered. God's going to send the sword to your house. Because you have scorned me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be a wife unto you, so says Adonai, behold, I shall raise evil against you from your own household. I shall take your wives away from before your eyes and give them to your fellow man who will lie with them in the sight of the sun. You took Uriah's wife, I want to take yours. Though you have acted in secrecy, I shall perform this deed in the presence of all Israel and before the sun. And here we are about 3,000 years later reading about David's sin. I tell you, when God reveals something, he reveals it big. So what does David do? Verse 13, David said to Nathan, I have sinned to Adonai. What more is there to say? I'm guilty. You're right. I'm dead wrong. Everything you said, I deserve. Everything you said is correct. I am guilty. I can't fix it. I can't bring Uriah back to life. I can't give Bathsheba back to him. This child of mine she's about to bear, I can't make that child Uriah's child. I can't undo any of this that I've done. As much as I can go back in time, I can't do that either. Nathan goes on. Nathan responded to David, so too, Adonai has commuted your sin. You shall not die. But there's always a substitution, isn't there? However, because you have thoroughly blasphemed the enemies of Adonai. That's a weird way. That the Hebrew, that's what it says. But what it means there is you've given the enemies of the Lord grounds for blaspheming him. Because you've so grossly misrepresented the God you claim to serve. The son that has been born to you shall surely die. All right? You'll stay alive, but this innocent child is going to die in your place. Nathan then went to his house, and Adonai struck the child that Uriah's wife had borne to David, and he became gravely ill. What does David do? You know what most people would do in this case? They would just pack their bags, head out to the wilderness, and just die. Curl up in a ball, crawl into a hole, and just die. And that's exactly what Satan would love for David to do. But David's a man after God's own heart, even though he'd sinned terribly. You know, there's something you have to remember, and the sages teach us often. They say that the reward of being a person in leadership, like a king, like David, is tremendous. But the temptations, the more spiritual you are, the more you've grown in the church of the Lord, the greater the temptations are. And when you fall, the greater the consequences are. So David, being this great spiritual leader, was greatly tempted, and he greatly fell. So before you're too hard on David, remember, David's up here, you're just here. So yours are fairly small consequences compared to a great leader like David. So what does David do? Nathan went to his house. God struck the child. It became gravely ill. Verse 16, David pleaded with God on behalf of the boy. David undertook a fast. And when he came in for the night, he lay on the floor. The elders of his house stood over him to raise him from the ground, but he would not consent, and he did not eat food with them. What did he do? Instead of feeling sorry for himself, he poured out all of his affection, all of his prayer for this innocent little baby that he had brought into the world through his own sin. Because David realized he needed to die. This baby was innocent. He fasted for 7 days, laid on his face for 7 days, prayed for this baby for 7 days. They tried to raise him up, but he wouldn't eat. He wouldn't move. Verse 18, it happened on the 7th day that the baby died. David's servants were afraid to tell him that the baby had died, for they said, behold, if when the baby was alive we spoke to him, but he would not listen to us, how can we tell him that the baby has died? He will do something, ra'ah is the Hebrew word, something evil. In other words, he'll probably kill himself. He'll go into a rage. He'll lose his mind. Verse 19, David saw that his servants were whispering to themselves, and David understood that the child had died. David said to his servants, is the child dead? And they answered, he's dead. All right, now think about this. Think of the guilt. Adultery, murder, bringing an illegitimate child into the world, this child being struck with illness and dying all because of you. And you can't change a thing. You can't make any of it better again. What do you do? This is where most people go out and kill themselves. This is where most people go out and they just become a hermit, a street person. They just nothing to live for anymore. What does David do? He follows Samuel's advice. David got up from the floor, bathed and anointed himself, and changed his clothes, and he came to the house of Adonai and prostrated himself. I wonder what he said, what he prayed. That you're right, just and upright in all of your works and all your judgments, all your deeds. I deserve to die. I deserve anything you bring upon me. I'm sorry, Father. Forgive me, because I can't change anything. But you are the great creator. And that makes you a great recreator. And David had often in Psalms talked about the future glory of the Messianic kingdom. And David realized the story's not over. God's still on his throne. He saw it all from the beginning. I messed up, but God's still perfect. And who am I going to serve if I don't serve him? I'm sure these kinds of things that went through his mind. He then came to his own house, and at his request they served him food, and he ate. His servants said to him, "What is this thing that you are doing? For the living baby you fasted and wept, and when the baby died, that's when you really start grieving. I mean, what's going on here, David? But when the baby died, you got up and ate a meal?" He said, "While the baby was still alive, I fasted and wept, for I thought, who knows? Perhaps Adonai will show me favor and the baby will live. But now that he is dead, why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I will be going to him. He will not return to me. But between now and the time I go to him," David's thinking, "I have a life to live. I still have some purpose. My life is in God's hands. I'm going to continue to live it." An amazing thing, there are some terrible things that happen in David's family after this. And some wonderful things too. Because Bathsheba has a second child by David, named Solomon, who became the most glorious king of Israel, the wisest man, who gives us the book of Proverbs, who gives us Ecclesiastes, the Song of Solomon. And David goes on to conquer the Ammonites, the one that Nachash was the general of, wipes them out. David went on to accomplish some wonderful, some great things. And then he lives to make sure that Solomon takes his throne and replaces David and becomes the next king of Israel. God wasn't done with David. But what if David just curled up in a ball and gone into a cave and just, "That's it. I'm going to pursue tohu." We need to be strong and choose life. Because we've all done things that are irreversible. All of us have. Whether purposely or by accident. But we should still choose life because God is still on his throne. He's not too worried about your sin. It hasn't threatened him. So let him do with your life what he's going to do. He can make some great stuff out of your life still, out of the wreckage. He can make some beautiful works of art. That's what the whole Bible's about. Yes?
Did David and Bathsheba ever hang that son?
I don't think so. They're not that I'm aware of. I could be wrong. I'm not aware if they ever named the child. Well, generally, the baby's named on the eighth day of life. Because if he lives through the first week, then at his circumcision, that is when he is named. But if he's not well enough to be circumcised, then they'll circumcise him on the eighth day, and he doesn't get his name till later. So it could be he died without even having a name. But that's a good question.
Ben David.
Yeah. Yes?
We haven't covered this too much, and I'm really curious about the
back in chapter 12 or here in, I mean in 2 Samuel or 1 Samuel?
2 Samuel.
Mm-hmm.
He chose this secret style to pick on your wives. But I'm wondering why what's significant is that God finds an unsuitable word of Taurus to reject was the penalty for adultery and that. Why what's significant is that he's saying that way he's coming to David.
Okay.
To me, it almost sounds, my human opinion, it almost sounds right.
Well, let's take us here 3,000 years later reading the story of David. What if nothing bad did happen to David? Then how would we interpret that for our own lives? Oh, well, I can do what David did and nothing bad happened to him. Maybe nothing bad happened to me. God allowed things to happen to David because David was an example to everyone in his lifetime and forward, even to today. It's important for us to see that sin has consequences. It did in David's life, and it will in ours.
Yeah.
Oh, I know, yeah. Yeah.
Two verses, and just for some reason, I don't know any other description about it, it just seems weird.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, we'll be getting to 2 Samuel somewhere down the road, and I'll find some answers to those questions. Those are good. So we'll try to address it. Yes, Dan. Yes, that sounds really confusing, doesn't it? We can't wait several months for that. I tell you, let's answer that question quickly, and then we'll close. Dan's question was, he's confused, and probably a lot of you are, and I said, David did not strictly break the letter of the law. Here's why. Whenever a soldier would go into battle, he would write a get, which is a legal document of divorce, to his wife. They still do that today. Because, for this reason, according to Jewish tradition and law, if the body of the dead husband is not found, maybe he's still alive, so the wife is not free to marry again, because there's no proof of the husband's death. So, when a man would go into to battle, he would divorce his wife, so that way, if he were to die and his body go missing, MIA, and his body's never recovered, his wife is least free to remarry. There's a wonderful story about 2001, September 11th, 2001, when the World Trade Center was hit by the terrorists. Up above, in one of the buildings where the plane hit in, there was an Orthodox Jewish man who had an office up there. And when it became clear to him, he was not going to get out of there alive. He got on his cell phone. He called his wife, whom he dearly loved, and divorced her over the phone. Because he knew he was going to die, and he did not want her to be trapped in widowhood the rest of her life. And sure enough, he did die. But she was free to marry after that, because they never found his body. So technically, Bathsheba was a divorcee when he saw her. Okay? And so when he took her in, she's a divorced woman. He could marry her. That's the purpose of divorce, to free the woman or the man to remarry. And so in David's mind, he's legally going through these legal loopholes. The spirit of the law, he's trampled. But the letter of the law, the letter of the law can blind us if we don't keep eye, if we get blind in our spiritual eye. And then, of course, when it comes to Uriah, well, David can command his troops however he wants. And if he wants Uriah at the front of the battle, right at the point that goes right into the attack, he can do that. And if he has some of the other guys step aside, he's probably thinking, well, if Uriah is really walking with God, God will preserve his life. He's not. Well, it's warfare. So you see, nowhere along the line did he legally break the letter of the law. But boy, when Nathan was done with him, David's eyes were open in a powerful way. Wow. Okay, yes, Dan.
But it's interesting because we were just reading in the book of Matthew this afternoon in the genealogy that was going through the Psalms. And when it came to Solomon, it said, son of David, by the wife of Uriah. Mm-hmm. You know, so it pulled that.
Yes. And even here, she's called the wife of Uriah. God preserved Uriah's name. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, Mike.
How tradition becomes law?
How tradition becomes law? Well, it's like this. What happens if you can't find your husband? How much time passes before you assume he's dead and you remarry? And so the Jews simply said, listen, we have to produce a body here. We just have to produce a body. And so what they did is, well, again, it's not a scriptural law, but it's one that just became part of Jewish law. All right? I mean, we have laws in America that aren't necessarily scriptural laws, but they became laws. Yeah. But that's a good question. Yeah. Jim, we're going to give you the final word.
Perhaps in the spirit of the law, commit By the letter of the law. Yes.
But he generally did commit adultery, whether it was the right or not.
Absolutely.
How do you reconcile him not breaking that law?
He did. It was in God's eyes, it was adultery, no question about it. In God's eyes, it was murder when it came to Uriah, no question about it. But, we often can use the letter of the law to excuse our own sins. The Pharisees are good at this. I mean, an example comes off the top of my head. The scriptures say, don't be drunk with wine, whereas in excess. Well, a person can read that and says, okay, I'll get drunk with beer. You know? So you're keeping the letter of the law? Sure are. Of course you are. Are you keeping the spirit of the law? No. Not so much. Right? You see what I'm saying? So the letter of the law is good, but it can be deadly if it does not have the spirit along with it. So, Kenny, we're going to give you the final word now. Yeah, it wasn't adultery. He just, he just committed serial marriage. Okay, with that note, we're going to bring this to a close. I'm thinking about how it's easy to become religious and keep the letter of the law and just live a life that's just so unattractive. I read a quote by Mark Twain. And he was discussing some religious people he knew. And he says, they are good in the worst sense of the word. And I thought, I know what he means. All right, let's close in prayer. Father, we do thank you for this time. Lord, your word is so filled with wisdom and we only scratch the surface. We only see the big print. But Father, I pray that even though we've not understood everything we've read, that even what we've read and not understood would still work its way deep into our spirits and feed us and nourish us and bring understanding over time. Lord, I pray that if we have committed things that are irreversible, and probably all of us have, Lord, we wouldn't lose hope. You are still God on your throne. Your love for us is still strong. And in many ways, we may be of greater use to you and not less, because now we're broken. So, Father, I pray you give us hope and help us to choose life. And we'll give you the praise for it in Yeshua's name. Amen. Mm-hmm.